disgusting scene. Absolutely disgusting. Hey, Lee, this is disgusting. Who sprayed tobacco juice all over John Gambling's pristine desk? A disgusting situation, John. Oh, the world is going downhill. This is me, friends. Uncle Wiggily. Happy Saturday to you. Happy Saturday to you. Just be careful. This is a crucial day. Happy Saturday to you. Singing the varied carols I hear, those of mechanics, each one singing his as it should be, lithe and strong. Sounds like America these days. Oh, poor Walt Whitman. How would he have handled the ILGWU? Or the doctor. That is funny when you think about it. I'm just looking at this. Listen to this. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine a guy getting up at the union meeting and he says, "Fellas, hey, fellas, now wait a minute. Just a minute, fellas." It's a union meeting, see, and they've been yelling and hollering and signs up strike. And four guys, "Ah, pinks, well, well." And this guy gets up and he says, "Ah, fellas, I want the floor for just a minute. Let me talk here for a minute. Shut up, will you? Hire me for crying out loud. Let me talk." And the guy up at the die, he says, We want to recognize the delegate from the 4th District back down the aisle. What do you want to say now? Get up and say it and get it over quick. We don't have all night here. After all, we've got the strike vote to take. All right, now, thank you. Now, I want to say this. I got a poem here that I want to read. And I want to read all this poem here. And I don't often read poems to the membership, but I want to read this poem because it may have some bearing on our strike vote, which we are going to take before midnight, and Lindsay is going to make a statement on WINS, okay? All right, now. I hear America singing. That's the name of it. And I'm going to now quote this poem by this guy named Walt. I hear America singing. The varied carols I hear, those of mechanics, each one singing his, as it should be, blithe and strong. The carpenter singing as he measures his plank or beam. The mason singing as he makes ready for work or leaves off work. The boatman singing what belongs to him in his boat. And the deckhand, that's us guys, the deckhand singing on the steamboat deck. The shoemaker singing as he sits on his bench. The hatter singing as he stands. The woodcutter's song. The plowboys on his way in the morning or at noon intermission or at sundown. The delicious singing of the mother or the young wife at work or the girl singing or sewing or washing. Each singing what belongs to him or to her. And to no one else. The day, what belongs to the day. At night, the party of young fellas, robust and friendly, like they are down at the candy store. The party of young fellas, robust and friendly, singing with open mouths their strong, melodious songs. Now, that's by this guy named Walt Whitman. And now, are you guys all ready to sing a song? All right, let's sing our strong, melodious song now. And gritty, they go down in the good old summertime. Oh, in the good old summertime. Wasn't that nice? It was old Bob Hall there blowing that trombone. And it's the last free day he's going to blow that trombone like that. I say, in the good old summertime. But speaking of this tobacco juice all over this desk is disgusting. Which one is it, Peter Roberts or is it John? Huh? It's John. It's funny, I'm looking at the tobacco juice. It is a Navy cup plug he's chewing. Not bad. John always did have good taste. Now, we have a little note here for those of you who, like little notes. Hey, before I go any further, I've got a question to ask on this Saturday night. It's just a little thing. It's been bugging me for months. I saw one time, not long ago, it's about 4 or 5 months ago, I saw on late movie, I mean, you know, the movie that comes on so late that you figure that there's only just two guys watching this movie, you and the spearmint gum guy. They're the only two ones. You know, the little guy with the pointed head comes on, builds those boats and all that, and sings that song about the double your pleasure, double your fun, all that stuff. Well, there the two of us were watching this movie one night, me and the spearmint gum guy. And this is the kind of movie that comes on. They cut off the last two reels to make way for Sunrise Semester. And, you know, the minister that comes on with the transcribed organ and all, it's 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching this fantastically old movie, so old that you could see that the lenses on the camera were not what they would call modern lenses. They were all made out of the bottoms of what looked like sarsaparilla bottles. They had to ground them down, and now they're handheld cranked cameras. You could see the camera jiggling up and down every scene because the cameraman... Did you know that at one point, one of the most valuable skills in Hollywood was the steady hand of a... You could become a cameraman if you had a sense of rhythm. Did you know that? Seriously. Well, because the camera was operated by your hand cranking the crank, you know. And if you cranked it too fast, everybody looked like they were running down the street out of their mind. You know, actually, the faster you cranked, the slower they walked. And if you cranked it very fast, you'd get this slow motion. If you cranked it slow, well, of course, everybody would jump out of the chair, run across the room, knock over the ferns, jump out. You know, you've seen this scene. And so a cameraman who could maintain a steady beat. Wow, 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 wow. Now, he didn't have to have any sense of composition. Anything like that. But if he could just grind that crank just right, wow, 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 everybody walked normal. Because and of course, a lot of films were shot during those days when there's a steady hand of the cameraman cranking away there. And that was the kind of film that I was watching. It was obviously shot during those days. And the kind of film that every television station has around the premises that's once in a while used just for a test. You know, they used it for leader. And they cut it off and stick it on the front of a real film. And I'm sitting there watching this film, and it is starring Ned Sparks. Did you ever hear of Ned Sparks? Well, Ned Sparks Ned Sparks is a kind of a legend in the film world. Ned Sparks was a kind of talking Buster Keaton. There was a parallel between Ned Sparks and Buster Keaton. He was the bridge. He bridged the gap between Buster Keaton and Slim Somerville. And he was a laconic, tall, skinny guy with a hatchet face. He always wore a hat. And he'd talk with this nasal talk. He was always saying, well, I don't know about that. Don't come around and tell me that cock and bull story. That was Ned Sparks. Well, I'm sitting up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Ned Sparks is starring in a film in which he is divorced. And that was the whole thing. And the entire film is Ned Sparks is on a boat riding back and forth to Hawaii. In fact, he couldn't get off the boat in America because they would slap him with a summons for alimony. And he couldn't get off the boat in Hawaii because they'd slap him with a summons for alimony. And so the entire film takes place with Ned Sparks riding back and forth to Hawaii. In fact, he made the trip 9 times, apparently, and every time he would arrive in Honolulu, I remember the scene, it was great, he would arrive in Honolulu, he'd just stand there at the rail and watch all the hula girls. And they're playing the music down there, you know. make a pretty good rotten Hawaiian guitarist, don't I? You want to hear me do that again? I get booked on the Lawrence Welk show, that kind of stuff. Not bad. Oh, wow. I think that anybody who likes Hawaiian music is capable of anything. And so the scene, this is what I'm getting at. The scene was a great scene. One of the great movie scenes I ever saw in my life. It shows Ned Sparks wearing his hat. And he wore this kind of hat. You know the kind of hat that the late James Gleason, who was in all the movies that made in a certain number of years, every movie had James Gleason in it. And Frank McHugh, those two guys were in every known movie that was shot in a certain period of years there. And you see them on thousands and thousands of movies now late at night. And Jim Gleason or James Gleason, he's always playing the fight promoter. Either that or he's playing the coach of the fighter. He's always backing a fighter. He also occasionally plays a bookie. And he's always saying, all right, you guys, now come on. Don't expect me to buy that scene, huh, do you? All right, now look, they're going off at 2-1 odds at Belmont, right? That's Gleason. He's always got this hat on the back of his head. Well, that's the kind of hat that Ned Sparks is wearing. And in this scene, this sad scene, I'm watching this scene there, and he's standing on the rail of the boat. He's looking down, and the hula girls are down there with their hips going and their arms waving in the air, and you could see those skirts floating in that soft Hawaiian breeze. And there were about 15 Hawaiians wearing these jazzy shirts, playing their Hawaiian guitars. And poor old Ned Sparks is looking down with that sad look. And all the people are going ashore, and they had these garlands of roses and orchids around their necks. And they're going ashore, and it's all romantic. See, they're all honeymoon couples. And here is Ned Sparks. He's on his 15th trip between the mainland and Honolulu, and the boat goes boom, 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 boom. That's pretty good. I make great sounds. And so Ned Sparks goes slowly out to sea, and as he goes out to sea, you can hear the Hawaiian guitars playing. And you see, floating on the tide, you see this garland of orchids floating out to sea. And this lady's standing next to him says, of course, you know what that means. That means that the next time you return, and that, since it is floating out to sea, the next time you return to Honolulu, you will find your true love. And Ned Sparks pops on his cigar. He says, that what that says? She says, yes, isn't that romantic? I've seen it before. And off in the distance you hear, boo, 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 boo. And I thought to myself, what a great movie. Because it's dealing with real life. Thousands and thousands of miles poor old Ned Sparks has clocked between San Francisco and Honolulu. And it was and as I sat and thought about this, and the little doublemint man came on came the transcribed reverend, and then on came Sunrise Serenade, I thought, could this be an allegory? Ned Sparks, could it be like the Flying Dutchman? Traveling forever across lonely seas, scudding before deep and mysterious winds, ever searching for the love of a true woman, or the true love of a woman, or the woman love of a true whatever, searching forever. Or could it have been an allegory on, say, the River Styx? And then I realized that I'd been up too long. It was time to go to bed. Well, the other gang. In the good summer time. Oh, all right, that's enough, Bob. That's enough. But speaking of good old summertime, listen, I have a summertime story in the current issue of Playboy, and I want you to read it. It is about the summer. And it's in the current issue, which is the July issue. And by the way, don't write to me. I'm always bugged every time a short story appears in Playboy. 500 guys write to me and say, gee, that was a great story, Shepard. Don't write to me. Write to the editor of Playboy and tell him that, you know? It isn't me, see? But nevertheless, this story, I think I had more fun writing this one than probably any one of the 14 stories that I wrote. I don't know why. It was just that doesn't mean that it's a better story or not. I just had a lot of fun writing it. Because, you know, some things turn out really great when you're writing, but you have a real struggle writing them. And it gets to be, you know, like the myth of Sisyphus. You know, you're pushing this thing up the side of a mountain, and when it finally comes out, it's maybe good, maybe not be. But the point is, you can never tell what you've done. You can never tell whether it's good or bad, depending on whether you've enjoyed it. Oh, yeah, I have many a musician friend of mine. He says, wasn't I great tonight? And he laid eggs all over the stage, but he was having fun, you know? And he thinks he was great. By the way, speaking of fun, a little note here that I've just got to get on with. Excuse me about bringing in Ned Sparks. But for those of you out there who are curious the way lives have been lived in the past, you know, after all, we're part of this great procession of mankind. We can't get away from it. But if you look at mankind in the aggregate, and the aggregate, by the way, you'll find the aggregate just below the left armpit, just above the floating rib. Right, Lee, I'm sorry. Now, what if Johnny Carson had said that, you'd have laughed. Now, I'm sorry. Now, there's nothing worse than an inflamed aggregate. You're terrible. You get that from a vitamin C deficiency. However, we're not here to talk about medical problems. But if you look at mankind in the aggregate, if you can imagine this gigantic procession like ants that started out sometime in the unimaginably far distant past, the first one crawled out of the mud, and he looked around and says, this is not bad for a real estate development. And another one crawled out, and the first one sold it to him. That began mankind's long... You know, have you ever thought about owning part of the earth? Have you ever really thought about how nutty that is in a way? That here was the earth, see, and there were no people at all on it, nothing. It was just a lot of mountains and volcanoes and oceans and stuff. And then a couple of frogs appeared, and a shrimp maybe, and somewhere an amoeba began to walk around down there in the bottom of the ocean, and a couple of protozoa, what is that great little animal they always talk about, the one-footed animal? It's a very basic animal. It's a very basic. It's just got a foot, and that has a little shell on the top of it. And these animals, a brachiopod, and these little animals began to move around, and the water was slashing back and forth, and the sun was beating down, and summer would come, and winter would come, and summer would come, and nobody cared. Nobody went to Jones Beach except the starfish and a couple of brachiopods. And ages went by, eons. The volcanoes stopped belching and blowing off the top every 50. Oh, yeah, they used to have a terrible time with volcanoes. You know, they had a lot of volcano problems right around here, you know. Oh, no? Oh, what? Where do you think all the rock came from around here, baby? I'm talking about way in the past. I mean, that was before Robert Moses, everybody. You know, it was a long time ago. And these things were, you know, shooting. They were an enormous... They were really... Hey, have you ever seen a volcano? Well, it's a very interesting sight when you see a volcano. Mount Vesuvius, you know, is a working volcano. And I remember one morning getting up in Naples. And it was morning time, and I looked out over the bay of Naples. You know, there's an old slogan. I remember I was about 7 in school. I was in about second grade when Miss Shields said, there is an old slogan. It's an old saying that says you can see Naples and die. You ever heard that? Well, I saw Naples. I don't know. You know, and I'm looking out over this bay, and I see way in the distance, I see Mount Vesuvius. You can see Mount Vesuvius, and this when the light is right, you can actually see the smoke rising from the top of Mount Vesuvius, a little smoke coming up the top there. And you're aware that there's a lot more around, believe me, than the Long Island Expressway. There's a lot of permanent things around, and they can be dangerous. See, and speaking of danger, this is WOR, friends. And this is your fun station. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, this is the Radio Free Broadway. And I'm me. And, you know, for what that's worth. And if you can imagine mankind, see, extending all the way back to the very beginning, the first brachiopod, he grows another tiny foot. And the frog that comes out of the water and he looks around. The first time he crawled out, he's an amphibious, see. And he has not tried walking around much, so he's walking around on the beach. And it slowly began to develop, this what we've got. One frog one day, this amphibian one day says, you know, it's kind of silly us walking around here on 4 feet like this and hopping. I wonder how it would be if I stood up on my back feet. Then I could look around better, see? And then I would be taller than the turtles. And, you know, anybody that's tall scares anybody that's little. So I'm going to get up and start. And he started to walk around. First, his knees hurt, of course, in the beginning there. When you're used to walking around on 4 feet, your knees hurt. And you have to make a few adjustments like that. And you have to get rid of the webbed feet. Although I have some friends that never did make that transition, still have webbed feet. So he finally, the first full-blown operating man was walking the earth. Now, we're not going to get theological here. There he was. He's walking around. And kind of lonely. And the waves are sloshing up on the shore. And jungle fronds are blowing in the wind. And he was shortly joined by another man. Well, let's put it this way, a chick. And a little hanky-panky there. And before you knew what happened, Brooklyn came into being. I'll tell you what a mess. It all started out there. You wound up with Route 22. Yeah, have you ever seen Route 9 on a Saturday night with all those 53 Fords bumper to bumper extending all the way to eastern Pennsylvania? The Dairy Queens, the yelling and hollering, the fist fights and the diners out there along Route 9. It all started out so simply, so unsuspectingly, elusively, sneakily. Unpretentious. A simple brachiopod. Now look what we got. Look around you. Well, all throughout the history of mankind, the same things have dogged mankind. Even to the extent, friends. Now, if you think you're out there on Route 9 there, and this chick cuts you off, and you say, oh, these women drivers, well, look at that nut. Holy smokes, what's she trying to prove? Wow, there she goes. Let me read a little note that I found at the bottom of the New York Times. Rome. The ancient Romans had problems with women drivers. Lady charioteers were not permitted to drive in the city on Sundays or during times of heavy traffic. I just thought you ought to know that not much has changed. Can't you see this lady charioteer making a wild left-hand turn after she has signaled that she's making a right-hand turn, and 700 horses go down in a big uproar and the wheels fly off, and it's Ben-Hur, he's on his way to a shield flies, and he says, what are you going to do? Get out of here, I'm on the way. The Roman legions are all tied up because a lady got jammed sideways on the Appian Way, and she never did learn how to back up her chariot. A lot of chicks out there don't even know how to back up a car, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, gee, I read that, and I says, geez, things have not changed much. And it's kind of good to know that. And speaking of basic things, we have another note here from Albuquerque. And this, how many of you remember here a couple of weeks ago I did this show about the worm farm, how I grew worms when I was a kid? Oh, yeah, growing worms for fishing is a great industry, and it's basic, you know. The earthworm is a part of our cosmos that not many people talk about. But without the earthworm, we'd be in one devil of a mess, really, if you'll excuse the expression. And the earthworm provides many things. And here's a note from Albuquerque. It's one of the saddest little things I've heard this summer. It's the beginning, you know. Nowhere you can't count on anything. Albuquerque, listen to this. the early bird got the worms. 20,000 of them, to be exact. Recently, from a northwest Albuquerque residence, 20,000 earthworms were stolen. The worms, which were being raised as bait for fishermen by the teenage son of the family, were taken from a worm bed behind this Albuquerque house by birds who arrived in the morning. 20,000 worms. Well, now, look. Summertime brings this out on us. There's something about the summer. We're all human beings, and we're all animals. We've got to remember that. I'm going to get some angry letters from people who refuse to concede that man is part of the animal kingdom. Well, the weight of zoology is against you, and the weight of biology, too. So, you know what happens in the summertime with any given animal. This is the time of great animal movement. Oh, yeah. Summertime comes, the deer come out of the forest. Summertime comes, the fish begin to move out from the deep water and begin to move into the shallow water. And they start striking at plugs and flies. Why? Well, it's summer. The water is warm. It turns them on. The juices begin to flow. And man is no different. Man begins to move out of his old winter haunts. He puts on jazzy sport shirts. He gets a Nehru jacket. He gets himself a new Mustang convertible. And he begins to move out over the horizon in search of who knows what. In search of it. In search of that terrible thing that lies deep within all of us. That grail, whatever it is. That moment of supreme, totally all-encompassing ecstasy. The summertime. The big moment. Yes, in a couple of days, it's going to be July. This is the last really official day of June. The last Saturday in June. June 29th. That date, by the way, has a certain peculiar significance to me. There was a girlfriend once that I had. And if you could... Incidentally, men, I'm talking to male types. How would it be right this minute, the summertime, this instant, if you were confronted en masse, in a body, by all the girlfriends you ever had? And they all arrived, and you had them in a room, say, like a classroom. And they all had a seat, little desk there, see. And they all filed in, one after the other, ranging all the way back to the time you were, say, 7. There was this chick named Betty that lived next door that you had this thing on. And they've all come in now, and they're all seated there before you, and they're waiting for you to make your appearance. Every last girl that you've been involved with, that you dated, a girl that you only saw one time once when you were in the Army in Joplin, Missouri, they've all assembled, and they're waiting for you to come in. The one thing that unites every one of these chicks, that at one time in their life peregrination across the great scheme of time and moment, they encountered you. Old friendly you. And now they've all arrived in this room. What a great opening for an allegorical play. And then this person, this universal master of ceremonies, stands up before all the women, all the girls, all the chicks, the pigs, all of them, clears his throat and says, probably most of you are curious as to why you have been summoned here. Well, there is one thing that unites all of you. And now, here he is. Here he is. Here he comes. Charlie Applerod. You remember him? And a dead silence falls over the room. And you walk in. And you don't know why you're there, see? The whole point is, you have not been warned as to what's going to happen to you, and they haven't been warned as to what's going to happen to them. You walk in, you look down, you see this group of strange ladies. You just looked out, and you look over to the left, and Gee, that's kind of a pretty... I've seen her somewhere before. You look over to the right, and there's a couple of angry ladies with their hair up in curlers looking at you. They're all wondering what they're here for. They think it's one of these advertising schemes where they're going to be asked to try Betty Crocker whoopie cake mix or, you know... By the way, speaking of that, have you seen... How many of those commercials have you seen where the woman says, Fig Newton cleaner because it makes things go ding, 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 sparkle. It's, wah, 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 wah. Those are the single most artificial, fake, unbelievable. And yet they're making a great attempt to be realistic. Like, whenever I get a headache, I take the stuff in a blue bottle. It relieves the pressure in the plane, and it makes me able to carry on my work. Yeah, it's real effective. Yeah, a couple hours it goes over, you're good. You know, we're all in it together. And Charlie Applewright looks down at that group of ladies. He looks from one end of the room to the other, and there's a tremendous number of them. Must be a couple of hundred, better more than that. And all of a sudden, he spots one halfway down the left there, next to the blackboard. And she is looking at him with two cold blue eyes. He looks at her. Oh, my God. No! Her! Holy smokes! And then his mind goes back to that time when he was supposed to meet this girl in Neosho, Missouri, in the drugstore at 8 o'clock. And he looks in there. He sees that she's there and remembers that he did not show up at 8 o'clock. And he never once contacted her. And she just looks with a cold blue eye. Charlie Applewright's up here. You are looking at the history of your life. And there's that girl that you were madly in love with at the age of 7. She now weighs 227 pounds. And it begins to slowly come back. All of them. Every last one. Who is that one over there? Oh, yeah. Oh, for crying out loud. I'll never forget that. Oh, no. And then there would be the ones that you couldn't even remember at all. Would it be a pleasant experience, do you think, Bob? You think so? Or would it be frightening? What would it be like? These things one does not know. Because the actual moment of Satori, the moment of inner realization, can be pleasant, it can be evil. It's like the time we went out on this picnic. You know, all families, the summertime comes, and families get this urge to go out. This is an old mankind urge to eat out. Have you ever wondered why, if we're supposed to be such a civilized creature? And we are, you know. At least this is what we all say. That we relate exquisite times with getting away from civilization and breaking out into the woods. There must be a reason for this. It has never been recorded, say, for example, the bears, who always eat out. Bears are on a continual picnic. It has never been recorded that three bears on a Sunday afternoon says, "Listen, Fred, what do you say we eat in? Let's all prepare to eat in Fred's living room this week." In short, we have an ancient, very deeply buried, but it's there, an ancient urge, almost an instinct, to return from the jungle from whence we sprang. And so, as the summertime gets hotter, and as it gets more jungle-like, by the way, and that we originated, if you know much about the origins of man, they generally say that man originated in the equatorial regions, that as it gets more equatorial in our area, we are driven to move out, and usually in a tribal unit. Very few people go out in the forest preserve or the woods by themselves to have a picnic. You move out a la the tribe. And so the tribe, what is the tribe? What is the modern version of the tribe? The family, of course, you know. And so every year at this time, families begin to move out into the boondocks for the picnic. Well, our family was absolutely the same. In fact, we had a family, of course. My mother had four sisters. Each sister came equipped with a husband. And each one of these marriages came equipped with anywhere from 2 to 8 kids. So you got the scene right there. There were two grandmothers involved. There were grandfathers. There were cousins-in-laws. And about, I would say usually 3 times a year, the entire crowd, the clan, would gather. Now, maybe this is a Midwestern thing. I don't think you see it as much here as you do out in the Midwest and the West. And that's called the reunion. Have you ever gone to a family reunion? You ever heard of a family reunion? They don't have them out here. I think the reason that reunions were so important out in the Midwest and the Far West was because the reunion had to do with the frontier life. And so at any given point when the family has scattered out all over the frontier, once a year or twice a year they would have a reunion and exchange news. They would all gather on the plain somewhere. You ever heard the stories of the mountain men? Every year they would have this big jamboree. That's what a jamboree is called. And they would all gather and get drunk and have a wild thing for about 3 days, and then they would go back into the mountains. Well, our family was very much like this. And every year at about the last week of June, the first week of July, just about the time that 4th of July was beginning to loom over the horizon, the letters would arrive. My Aunt Clara was always the organizer of this. Aunt Clara would write. My mother would get the letter. And my old man, all right, so it's another weekend shot. And she would say, well, we're going out to the forest preserve now. Carl is coming and Uncle Al is coming. The whole crowd is coming. And I remember one specific family picnic that will always remain with me as one of the great highlights of my life, one of the great moments of my life, that we had gathered, the entire clan, and there must have been about, there must have been 75 people. And the whole crowd had gathered on the shore of a river called Fox River. Have you ever heard of Fox River? Oh, yeah, whenever I read stories of the movement west, they're always talking about the Fox River. Well, if you don't know where the Fox River is, part of the Fox River is in Illinois, and it flows not too far out on the prairies. It flows out there in the Chicago area, and the Fox Indians used to live on this river. And they had this great rock called Starved Rock, and that was where the Fox Indians were gathered in some kind of a siege, and they starved or something on that big rock. And they used to, they have a lover's leap there. It says here, the Indian lovers. leap, you know, they're always lovers leap. And so we would go to the Fox River Grove, big forest preserve, thousands of other families for miles around, and this beautiful river would flow like it was a fast river. And it was about, at that point, maybe 3/4 of a mile, maybe a half mile across, fast flowing river. And it was flowing towards Chicago. That river flowed down, it flowed and it joined the Chicago River and moved on into the great basin of the Great Lakes. And this was the country where you find arrowheads and you find busted Indian shards and that kind of stuff. And on this particular hot weekend, just before the 4th of July, very much like this, the temperature stands at about 95 degrees. And it was the kind of temperature, you know, where you have this humidity, you could cut pieces of moisture right out of the air. And the long trail led for all the different families all over. And, of course, the big problem was getting transportation. We had about 500 different types of transportation. The old man had the Oldsmobile. But my Uncle Carl, particularly, he worked for this cleaning place. And he had this old cleaning truck with a panel truck. And he took about maybe 50 or 75 people in the truck. They all piled up in there, and away they went, hot, everybody. And about 3 or 4 days before the big thing would happen, there's about 50 phone calls made as to who's going to provide the potato salad, who's going to put dogs. And everybody had a specialty. My Aunt Min, for example, her fantastic specialty was pineapple upside-down cake. And I do not know whether you have ever seen a pineapple upside-down cake after it's been on a picnic ground with a temperature 95 degrees with maybe 28 million flies. So that all this stuff is laid out. We have now gone down to the picnic. The kids are yelling and hollering, and it's heating up. Well, along with this picnic business, all the uncles got together. Uncle Al, Uncle Carl, uncles that never saw each other that had moved out to places like Iowa. There was a guy named Uncle Emil, who I only saw once a year at the big picnic. They referred to it as a picnic. Uncle Emil would show up, and his wife Mabel. They would come from Dubuque. You never hear me talk about Uncle Emil. Uncle Emil was a wild one. And they would all show up, and they would line up and down this river and take over a whole section of the river, maybe about a block section. And that would be the family reunion, the potato salad. And along with this stuff always went beer. And therein lies the nub of the story I am about to tell you, this great moment. Every family, if you take 25 men out of any given group of people, there will be one man, maybe sometimes two. This is a statistical fact. One man, maybe two, out of any 25, will be verging on alcoholism, a drunk. I mean, and this is why that any large family, statistically, almost every large family had in its midst one drunk. Uncle Carl was our drunk. But Uncle Carl was a kind of drunk this was his era. He was as much part of that era as, say, Louis XIV was part of that era of France. He epitomized it. And Uncle Carl was always out of work. And he had this old truck that somewhere along the line he had gotten from a job that he'd had years before. It was an old pickup truck, panel truck, really. And it had the name of a cleaning company on the outside. And the cleaning company's name had faded into the blue paint of this truck. And he drove this truck around always in his life. And he would sit on the running board of it and play his banjo. He was a fanatical banjo player, and a great banjo player, by the way. The only thing he excelled at, that and drinking. Play the banjo. So Uncle Carl was always the life of the party. He'd play the banjo. He was a Swede. He played the banjo. He would tell jokes. He did magic tricks. He played with the kids. And all the kids were ape about Uncle Carl. They loved Uncle Carl. And Uncle Carl would get about three beers under his belt, and he would jump up on a table, and he'd do his famous imitation of Sally Rand, which he would do. And all the women would yell and holler, and he'd do this thing. Then he'd play the banjo. Then he would tell stories. Then he'd get three more, maybe four more beers. And then he would get even better. And so by the middle of the afternoon, when the heat is rocking down, Uncle Carl has a great collection around him. Kids from other family reunions would join our family reunion to hear Uncle Carl. He's playing ball with the uncles, and he had all kinds of... He would do slow motion tricks, for example. He would get out on the pitching mound. They always had the married guys and the single guys would play, and the cousins and the uncles would play each other. And he would get out there, and he would do his famous slow-motion imitation of Dizzy Dean. Well, I don't know whether you've ever seen a slow-motion imitation of Dizzy Dean being done by a drunken Swede with the temperature standing at 97 degrees, but it is one of the great theatrical experiences. And Uncle Carl would fall off the mound, and his teeth would come out, and Aunt Min would get mad. And so finally, they drag Uncle Carl off the ball diamond, and then he would take up his stance on the side of the diamond, making comments, playing his banjo. The high point of the visit every year to the Fox River Grove was to go down to the beach, and this beach that ran right along. Now, remember, friends, this is a river. Have you ever swum in a river? Have you ever been swimming in the river? This is not like swimming at Jones Beach. It is not like, say, going to a lake. This is a river. And it had this wild current. This current would rush right down, boy, this baby, and upstream about 3 or 4 miles, there were the rapids. You could hear the rapids. That stream moved, and it was going faster and faster. You see, it is now approaching the lake, Lake Michigan. And so we would wade out. It was cold. The water was icy. There were cattails. And we would wade out, and we would stand up to our knees, And we always had a blow-up horse, you know, the kind of horse that's blown up with the red ears and that, and the kids would jump up and down. And this was the great era of the inner tube. No swimming party ever went anywhere, I don't care who it was, unless they had an inner tube. And a great big, fat, black inner tube with red patches on it. You've seen these things. Well, Uncle Carl was magnificent with the inner tube. And he was a great swimmer, too. That was another thing about him. He was the kind of drunk who could do everything except work. He could do all this great stuff. For example, he had a trick in the inner tube where he would swim underwater and then shoot out of the water like a fish right in the middle of the inner tube, you know. Just fly out of the inner tube and dive backwards over out of the water and not touch the inner tube. He would just do this. He'd go flying out. And the kids would, right, Uncle Carl, wowee. Well, on this afternoon, Uncle Carl is now in his inner tube, with his feet sticking out one side, his head sticking out of the other side. He's got his straw hat on. He had his flat straw skimmer. And he's playing his banjo. He is floating about 20 feet offshore. Now, people at first were, you know, they were all watching Uncle Carl play the banjo, and they're cheering. The kids are cheering. And then we got playing our own games. And you know how the excitement goes. There's 75 people. And suddenly somebody came down and says, "Where's Carl?" And one of the kids says, "Oh, he was over here playing a banjo." And someone says, "But there he is out there. Out in the middle of the Fox River. Uncle Carl had been caught by the current. And now Uncle Carl is out in the middle of the river in his black all-state inner tube playing his banjo and being carried slowly downstream, totally oblivious to the fact that he is in 40 feet of water. And the stream is carrying him down." Well, of course, instantly there's a lot of yelling. "Hey, Carl's out there. The river's got him. The other toe's got Carl. Hey, look. Holy smokes. Cry." And the father's my uncle. All the uncles and everything, they're running downstream. And they're trying to catch Uncle Carl. And Uncle Carl is floating out there in the middle of the Fox River and gaining momentum. Well, somebody says, "Look, let's go down and catch him at the bridge." They ran out, they got in the car, and they drive out and back. They get on U.S. 19 or whatever the heck it was, and they're instantly in a fantastic traffic jam. They're trying to get down to the bridge, which was about a mile and a half downstream, to try to catch Uncle Carl before he was swept even further downstream. Well, they're in the middle of this traffic jam. I remember I'm sitting in the back seat of the car, and there's yelling and hollering, and somebody called the police. There's a lot of excitement going on, and they finally made it down to the bridge just in time to see Uncle Carl about a half a block on the downstream side of this bridge. He had just made it under the bridge, and now he's down going towards the big dam. Well, now, friends, they had a dam there where the water dropped about 30 feet, and, you know, the kind where it goes, you see those dams? People are running along the shore, and you can see guys with bicycles and banjos playing. Uncle Carl is sitting out the middle, totally oblivious. He's playing a banjo. And my Aunt Min is wringing her hands. You know, for years she's been always saying how she would like to get rid of Uncle Carl. Now Uncle Carl is being swept downstream. And you can see that old straw skimmer shining in the sun, and you can hear him out there. He's playing "Sweet Georgia Brown." I remember he played and he's moving faster and the river's getting wider, friends. Well, I want to tell you, this saga went on for about an hour and a half. They chased him through one town and another. They went through Algonquin, Illinois. They went through Berrien Springs, Illinois. They went through Des Plaines, Illinois, all these various towns. And Uncle Carl went right through the middle of town playing his banjo. People would see him. They couldn't believe what they were watching. And that was the greatest. I'll tell you, that all-state, you know the story of this guy that just went from Africa to Fort Lauderdale in a sixth boat? You should have heard the talk that was going around about Uncle Carl was possibly heading for the St. Lawrence Seaway. In his off state, totally oblivious. And people would run along and say, "Hey, Carl, hurry up, try to go. Hold on, Carl." And he'd look around playing his banjo. Well, friends, 7.5 hours later, Uncle Carl, by the way, went over that dam, believe me, like Grant took Richmond. Or was it Sherman took Atlanta? He went over that dam, and apparently it never bothered him one bit. He went down that 30 feet of water, hit the bottom of that thing, and kept right on going, playing his banjo. They finally caught Uncle Carl at the Great Locks, just before the Fox River joined the Chicago Drainage Canal. Which would have been, by the way, I suspect, a symbolic end to his trip. They caught Uncle Carl. They pulled him out of the water down there. And Uncle Carl, instead of showing gratitude for being saved, Uncle Carl was bugged that they caught him in the midst of the greatest boat trip he was ever going to take. And bugged about it. Well, they took him in. His inner tube, his straw hat, and somebody had alerted the newspapers. That's a fact. And they were on hand when he was rescued. And have you ever seen pictures in the newspaper where it says, unidentified man rescued, that shows the police pulling a guy out? Well, here is Uncle Carl standing with his striped bathing suit. He had the kind, you know, with the straps over the top of the stripes. It shows Uncle Carl standing with his striped bathing suit, holding in one hand his banjo, and in the other hand, he's holding his Allstate inner tube. And underneath it says, man rescued from drowning in Fox River. What a lie. Man rescued from drowning in Fox River. Uncle Carl was so bugged that appeared in the Chicago Tribune, and for miles around, people were calling up Uncle Carl and asking him for his autograph. He became a great celebrity overnight. And this voyage, friends, to this day, is sung about in folk songs out in the Midwest. The trip of the old Uncle Carl down the old Fox River. One of the great sagas. It ranks with Ahab. It ranks with Chichester. It ranks with Lindbergh. But some people get their names inscribed on columns of marble. Others just remain forever part of the great folklore of the life of the walking around, scratching, spitting human being. And somewhere where Uncle Carl resides in this far-off day, in heaven, in Mount Olympus, he still remains the greatest single navigator in the whole history of inner tube sailors.